The second speaker is Dr. Arita Jones. She's currently over at the University of South Australia. Arita actually got her PhD in astrophysics at ANU back in 2012, and she also worked overseas for a couple of years as a research associate over in Canada. And now she's come back to Australia to further her work on Mars. The talk today that she's going to be doing is basically talking about search for water on Mars and also in other worlds. So I'll just turn you over to Arita to tell you more now. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne. Can everyone hear me okay? I'm one of those people who walks when I talk, so I'm going to try really hard not to do that, but let me know if I fade in and out. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about how we search for hidden subsurface water environments on other planets. So the emphasis is going to be on Mars, but the approaches that I talk about are relevant to other bodies in the solar system like Enceladus, Europa, Ganymede. I think it's really useful to reflect on how we search for water, how we can identify water, because that helps direct us towards what information, what data do we want to gather from other planets. Mainly what I'm going to talk about is how do we detect and characterize liquid water environments or any water environments in the solar system based on most of our data arising from sometimes in situ, but mostly remote sensing and predominantly arising from the surface materials or the shallow subsurface. So how do we learn about those much deeper hidden water environments? I also want to touch a little bit on what is the role of comparative planetology. So what is the role of using the Earth to learn about these environments on other planets? And can we go the other way? Can we also learn about the Earth as well? The typical kind of motivation and my personal motivation and interest in looking for liquid water environments is that it provides us with constraints on habitability. So the ability of environments on other planets or moons to potentially support life, assuming that it has similar requirements to organisms here on the Earth. And that is a requirement for liquid water in those environments. But a really good point that was made at the excellent Pluto and Jupiter talk on Monday was that it's also really important to understand water because that constrains the water budget of a planet, constrains how that planet formed and also the evolution of the planet as well. Essentially, because I really like pressure temperature diagrams, I just wanted to show this one that shows some different fluids that have been discussed in terms of being possibly biologically relevant, the key one obviously being water, and some different environments in the universe. But in order to search for liquid water, that phase of water that biology uses, we're essentially looking within a really constrained range of pressures and temperatures. So how have we learnt about liquid water on Mars? Well, these are kind of the key sources that our knowledge has been derived from. So firstly, we've gone to 7 different locations on the Martian surface. So they give us in situ measurements of water vapor in the atmosphere and water in the soil. But using drilling on Curiosity, using scooping on Phoenix Lander, for example, we've gotten measurements within the top 10, 15 centimeters of the subsurface. So these are very superficial measurements. We also have evidence in situ and orbitally of water surface interaction. Also, we have hydrogen concentrations of the subsurface, and those are inferred to be concentrations of water ice and in some cases also hydrated mineral signatures. And we have some radar remote sensing of Mars as well. This is predominantly, in terms of the process data, is predominantly at the poles, but we have also learnt about the presence of water at lower latitudes. So an example is fluvial channels that were buried under lava flows in Elysium Planitia. But as you can see, most of our information on water on Mars is derived from the shallow subsurface. So how can we learn about deeper water on Mars and on other planets? So obviously one method is direct detection. I'm going to talk mostly about surface expressions. And then 2 other ways that we learn about water would be through modelling, so numerical simulations, and also experimentally, so through laboratory investigations. But because of the time constraints, I'm just going to focus on talking about surface expressions of water. Also, the role of comparative planetology, so looking at Earth, and the importance of multivariate approaches. Direct detection would obviously be our preferred way of identifying water. It gives us a definitive answer as to whether or not water is present in an environment, but it's probably limited to mostly going to tell us about contemporary liquid water on a planet. So here we have observations made by Curiosity, looking at hydration states within the soil, and this is evidence of a perchlorate brine in the liquid phase at Gale Crater, where Curiosity is. And these were the results that were released in September last year and discussed at this conference. So this is presence of hydrated salts left behind in these RSLs, or these briny liquid flows on Mars. That's an example of both in situ and orbital detection of water. But I'm going to focus mainly on surface expressions of water. So what do I mean by surface expressions? Essentially, these are indirect indicators of water. These are indicators that at some time within the geologic history of this body, liquid water or water ice interacted with the surface materials. Three different categories of surface expressions are morphologies, geochemistry, and the physical properties of those surface materials. So I'm going to give some examples of what I mean by that, how they can be useful, and also some recent research that's gone on in each of those areas. But I want to first bring it back to the Earth. So this is an example of the Lake Eyre Basin. And we can learn a lot by how we look for subsurface groundwater. So these are liquid water environments that we can't see. There's flies hanging around. This is some of the traditional methods for learning about groundwater in the Earth. So remote sensing groundwater. So obviously some of these not relevant so much to Mars. So looking at springs, present day springs, obviously not relevant. Looking at vegetation, not relevant to Mars. But some of these other techniques are relevant. So looking at drainage features on the landscape, looking at the shape of these features and their density, helps provide information on how water flowed across the surface and where water was directed downwards into the subsurface to recharge an aquifer, for example. Also looking at the composition of particular soils, which soils are able to store water, the permeability of soils and how they direct that water downwards. Also looking at lineaments in the landscape. So a number of these are relevant to searching for water on other bodies as well. One of the categories of groundwater surface interactions is morphologies, and a lot of work goes on in the Martian field to look at different shapes in the landscape that may have been formed due to the interaction of liquid water. So we have gullies, those briny liquid flows, for example, amazing deltas, and also the presence of ice, such as these lobate debris aprons or things that look like glaciers on Mars. So how do we study these features? We typically look at their spatial distribution, so where these features are clustered might be indicative of somewhere where you had more interaction with water. We would look at the relative ages of these features, but they're very hard to constrain. Each of these morphologies is very small spatially, so it's very difficult to look at, for example, the number of craters that form on these features. So instead, we would look at superposition relationships, so the geological context of these features and the age of the terrains that they form on. So in terms of looking at the attributes of these features, we would use multispectral remote sensing. We would use terrain data to look at the depth, the height. So what is the depth at which the fluid came out from the wall of a crater, for example, or how long was the channel, and consequently how much material was carved out by the flow, those sorts of things. Some issues with this is that in terms of geomorphology, our interpretations frequently rely on the similarity of these features to features on Earth. So the underlying assumption is often that if a feature occurs on Mars that is morphologically similar to something on Earth, then perhaps it formed due to similar processes. And that's not always the case. And it's also difficult, again, as we heard in the Pluto talk, there are morphologies on Pluto that simply wouldn't occur on the Earth because there are processes that occur due to the low temperatures there that simply don't occur on Earth. And we have that in the Martian case as well. There's translucent CO2 ice and these spider gazes that come out of it, and we don't see those processes on the Earth. So I'll talk a little bit about gullies because these are really enigmatic, interesting fluvial morphology on Mars, and there's so much that we still don't know about them. So there's a huge range of morphologies of gullies on Mars. There's not just one Mars gully. They're very heterogeneous. And consistent with that, there are many different theories that have been put forward about how these features form. Many of those hypotheses involve liquid water, but some of them involve very little water or mostly dry suggestions. Some of them even involve CO2 instead of H2O. So to give you an example of how different gullies can be, so this is kind of the typical Martian gully that has a strong terrestrial analog in terms of the visual similarity. So we would have an alcove, we have deep channels where a lot of material has been carved out, and we have these debris aprons where the material was deposited as the fluid disappeared. And we also have in a number of these systems new flows that have occurred that indicates that these processes are still occurring on Mars. We also have very different gullies. So these gully systems, this is an example in a dune field, they have no alcove, they have no debris apron, and these channels are very narrow and very shallow. So these suggest possibly very different processes that are occurring, or perhaps different abundance of water that form these features. The involvement of liquid water with these features is indicated firstly by their morphology. So you would have the redirection of channels around obstacles suggests the presence of a fluid. You would have channels that come together form a wider channel, again suggestive of a fluid. Looking at the substrate that these features form in, the timing of activity, a number of their preferences. So here is an example of, this is a recent map that was produced and gives a global distribution of gullies. So this author, Tanya Harrison, looked at over 60,000 high-resolution images of Mars. It took quite a few years, but she produced this map of Martian gullies. And the colours here give the orientation preference of those gully systems, so whether or not they're facing the equator or the poles. And we see a change as we move with latitude from poleward-facing to equator-facing. And what that tells us is that these features are linked in some way to the solar heating that they're receiving. But the spatial distribution is not at all simple. Here you can see an example of three impact craters that form simultaneously, and we know that because there's no ejecta in filling any of these craters. But only the central crater has a gully system, the other two don't. So these formed within a very similar substrate of the same age, but yet only one has a gully system. So the local distribution of these systems is very complicated to explain. Another clue that they are liquid or related to liquid comes from looking at the substrate that the gullies originate in. So this is a global surface material map that myself and a number of other colleagues worked on. And when we look at where these gullies occur, we see that they occur within, they have a strong relationship to particular types of surface materials. And those surface materials are the ones that give the warmest subsurface environment. So again, we have that link to the origin of these features and warm temperatures in the subsurface regolith, indicative perhaps of melting of ice and the involvement of a fluid. But there's many issues that we still need to explain about how these features formed, such as some of the morphologies, the orientations, what is the source of water, how did it remain stable, was it stable during the time period that these features formed, and how do we make them fit in with the current climate models, for example. We have a range of terrestrial analogues that people study from a lot of different environments to try and understand these features. Some recent research from Steve Hobbs here is looking at some Martian gully analogues, and this research is useful, and a number of other people are doing this kind of work as well, because it suggests that Some of the diversity that we see in these morphologies on Mars may not just be due to whether or not liquid water was involved or how much, but it can also be strongly influenced by the surface materials that these gullies are forming in. So the regional geologic context of these gullies can create very different systems. So another morphology that is frequently studied on Mars, and one that I'm really passionate about, is these layered ejecta craters. So an example is in the background here. You can see the really distinct lobate fluidized appearance of the ejecta of these craters, and it's thought to form from the excavation of subsurface water that's incorporated into that ejecta and makes it have a fluidized flow across the surface. But there's many issues in understanding these morphologies. How much water is needed to give you this kind of appearance? Or do we in fact need water at all? Can you replicate this kind of flow just by using something that is really fine-grained, has a low viscosity and flows really well without the need for water? I was doing some work last year on trying to address this issue of whether or not water is involved and how much water is needed to form these features. And do we see a continuum of features that incorporated more water versus those which incorporated less? And what are the attributes of these craters when we're measuring them using remote sensing? What is it about them that is most strongly linked to the presence of water? So in this research, I looked at over 10,000 of these craters on Mars and 21 different factors that were measured. So these are things that might be related to water. So the dimensions of the crater, the dimensions of the ejecta, the age of the terrain they're forming in, etc. And what I found was that there's a number of different factors that are really resulting in all the variation that we see in these features. So the top two most important ones are firstly simply the energy of the impactor that formed these impact craters, but secondly we have this index of target volatiles, or in other words the incorporation of water in the pre-existing target rocks and incorporated into the ejecta flow. So using that research, we can look for, okay, where on Mars are these craters telling us that there was the highest abundance of subsurface water? And by using those other indices, we can search for essentially small recent craters that provide us evidence of recent water in the subsurface of Mars. And this is derived from that research, gives us a relative depth to water, water ice within a region of Mars. So this is one method that is using PCA, not in the more traditional way of reducing the noise in your data or reducing the dimensionality, but it's using it to identify these latent variables, these hidden variables that are underlying what we see on the surface. Another surface expression of water on Mars is geochemistry. So in other words, hydrous minerals, for example, and other types of geochemistry can provide evidence of the interaction between water and the rocks at the surface. So one example that's very important in the Martian case would be iron and magnesium phyllosilicates. So these clays form from long-term interaction between liquid water and rock and in neutral to alkaline conditions. So these have been observed in situ by Curiosity, and they've also been observed using orbital reflectance, and it's near-infrared and infrared that's particularly important wavelengths for looking at clays. So by looking at where clays are observed on Mars, we can again infer from the geologic context whether or not they were formed in situ or whether or not they've been transported to the locations that we're seeing them. We can look at their spatial relationships in order to infer when water was present and what locations, what environments water interacted with the surface. Many of the clays that have been observed on Mars have been inferred to be ancient. They're seen in these Noachian age terrains, predominantly within impact craters. And the hypothesis is that these clays were essentially buried, they were present in the subsurface, and they were exposed and excavated by these impact craters that formed over 3.7 billion years ago. But they provide us with information on the extent of habitable liquid water environments in the past. So here are locations of clays in the green here on Mars, and you can see that they predominantly occur in these old Noachian terrains and not in the younger terrains in the northern hemisphere. So here the clays are categorized, and we can see some regions where they cluster, so where most of these clays are observed, and here we have observations that didn't have any clays. But recent research has indicated that some of these clays might in fact be much younger, that rather than being excavated by the impact craters, they actually formed subsequently to those impact craters and were related perhaps to hydrothermal systems that were generated by those craters. And that provides us with important information on much more recent liquid water and possible hydrothermal systems on Mars. Another example is looking at these fluidized channel morphologies on Mars that have observations of salt. So all of the new flows that we've seen occur on Mars in recent high-resolution imagery have all occurred at temperatures well below the freezing point of pure liquid water. Some of them were around minus 10, but some of them occurred as low as minus 50 when new flows were occurring. So in order for liquid water to be flowing under those conditions, it must be briny. It must have a salt that's allowing it to be a liquid. Salts have been observed everywhere that we've looked on Mars, a range of different salts, perchlorates, carbonates, nitrates, now with Curiosity, and also chlorides. And these salts are important because they enable water to be liquid at the conditions present on the surface in the current Martian climate. And they also allow liquid water to accumulate to sufficient volumes in order to influence the surface materials and form these morphologies that we observe. So I would suggest that for Mars, follow the salt is a really important strategy to use because it appears to be a key surface expression of liquid water on Mars. So here is an example of chlorides, essentially a salt pan that's formed at the end of a channel within a basin. So you can see here the measurement of the chlorides from remote sensing, and if we zoom in to this region here, the chlorides are associated with this white kind of fractured terrain that you see. So we can relate this again back to looking for groundwater on the Earth. Here is an example of some springs in the Lake Eyre Basin that I've been researching. And in this area, it's these salty evaporite deposits that provide really important information on the presence of groundwater. These salts are left behind from the diffuse discharge of groundwater in these environments. So they're an important surface expression that gives us clues that liquid water has interacted with these surface materials. Also from looking recent research looking at these briny flows, these RSLs on Mars, has found that, so we know that salts are important, but in fact the volume of liquid water that carved out these flows may be a lot more than can be explained by simply this deliquescence phenomenon. So this is a phenomenon of pulling water vapour from the atmosphere that was used to explain these phenomena. But in fact, looking at them in Valles Marineris, this is a map of RSLs in the Valles Marineris Canyon system, they're a lot larger than you would think you could explain just from water vapour in the atmosphere. So the suggestion is that the melting of ice or the upwards movement of groundwater, similar to this terrestrial case, may be important in explaining these features on Mars as well. And there's also a lot of analog research done to learn about clays on Mars. So we have these basalts, so analogous to Martian rock, in both cold and warm conditions on the Earth, and we can look at how they alter due to interaction with liquid water to form clays, similar to what we see on Mars. So the final surface expression that I'll quickly talk about is looking at the physical properties of the materials. So by physical properties, we can talk about the strength of the materials, their density or their porosity, and their behaviour thermally as well, so their conductivity, their heat capacity. So one way that we look at this is by quantifying the grain size and how indurated the surface materials are, because we can do this via remote sensing using the infrared, and particularly the thermal infrared, and looking at the heat of the surface materials, which is dominated by the thermal conductivity. It tells us about the grain size. Why is this useful to learn about water? Well, the reason it's useful is that specific grain size trends are expected from certain interactions. So if we look at channel deposits on the Earth, we find specific ranges of grain size, and not just the sizes, but also the shape of those grains as well. So looking at rounding versus angular. We also know that grain sizes can provide us with information on the abundance of water in the subsurface when that material is excavated by impact craters. But here is some research looking, so this is in situ imagery from Curiosity, and looking at the shapes of pebbles that Curiosity has seen and how well-rounded they are. And this provides information on the length of time that the rock interacted with water, the velocity of that water flow as well. Grain size is also important because, as I said, it relates to temperature, it relates to how heat is conducted through the materials, and this controls the moisture profile within the shallow subsurface on Mars, how that solar heating is distributed down into the subsurface. A lot of analog research is important here. A lot of research has been done on groundwater systems on the Earth and the importance, again, of surface grain size and soil temperature in telling us about the presence of a deeper aquifer underneath the surface. So these are also important for remote sensing hidden liquid water on the Earth as well. One of the issues, however, in looking at grain size is that we have difficulty distinguishing what's aeolian, so what is formed by the wind and deposited by the atmosphere, versus what is formed by the presence of a fluid. So some recent research here by Sullivan and Zimbelman looks at how we can tell that a feature was formed by the wind versus by the presence of a fluid. Also on Mars, we have this problem of dust coverage, and that's an issue for remote sensing of grain size because dust is a thermal insulator, so it essentially masks the signatures of the materials beneath it. The key point that I wanted to make is that I think that further significant advancements in understanding the presence of water and liquid water in the subsurface of Mars and also on other planets is really going to rely on a synthesis of different approaches. So taking these different methods, looking not just at one morphology and where it occurs, like gullies, but looking at their intersection of many different morphologies and also the importance of using our surface observations to constrain our numerical models as well. And it's been really well demonstrated in studies of groundwater on the Earth that the detection of hidden groundwater environments is improved by the integration of many different data sets. So soil characteristics, the attributes of the terrain, the atmospheric conditions, the density of different fluvial morphologies that we see. So a multivariate approach is really important. Just to finish, where else we might look for these liquid water environments in our solar system? Obviously, Enceladus is really important and really exciting. We have these water vapor contain also water ice and some basic organics in these jets, and they point us towards a warm global liquid water ocean. And the salinity is estimated to be very similar to Earth, so around 4% salinity within this ocean. Unfortunately, this is estimated to be quite a deep ocean, so underneath quite a thick water ice shell. But recent modelling suggests that the chemistry, looking at the chemistry of these jets and inferring the chemistry and possible pH of this ocean, suggests that there may potentially be cold, low-temperature hydrothermal systems at the base of that ocean. And if that were the case, that would provide us with important chemical energy sources for life, because liquid water is not enough. We also need energy and we need nutrients as well. So another exciting place to look at is Europa. evidence of a possible liquid water ocean, possibly rich with sodium chloride, and also possibly in touch with rock at the base, which gives us that source of nutrients for life as well. At the moment, the thickness and the depth of this ocean in Europa isn't very well constrained, but the recent results that were discussed yesterday that have jets, so water vapor jets, kind of similar to Enceladus, emanating from the South Pole, most likely water vapor, suggests that at least in some places the icy shell of Europa is not as thick as we previously thought it was. And another exciting candidate is Ganymede, that also possibly has a liquid ocean of sulfates. And a recent model to try and understand the structure of the interior of Ganymede, their hypothesis that they put forward was that the ocean may in fact be layered within these icy layers. Or more accurately, they suggest that there's this continuum of density due to the density of salt, and you get these more dense layers as you go deeper within this ocean icy shell of Ganymede. So lots of exciting frontiers to explore. Thank you very much.